And then, Marshall, when you're able, you can call the next case.
The second case is A23-1308, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Wilford John Boyd Appellant.
Good morning, counsel. You are all familiar with the appellate procedures and process here, but I'll run it down anyway. So both parties will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium does adjust. It's right in the center, sort of below the microphone there, where you can adjust it up and down based on your height. Feel free to get yourself settled in, and appellant's counsel, when you're ready, you can proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Jeremy Cron, and I represent appellant Wilford John Boyd in this matter. This case started with an otherwise routine traffic stop when State Trooper Fay pulled over the vehicle that Mr. Boyd was driving. But unlike most traffic stops, this one was expanded to include a dog sniff of the vehicle. In order to do so, the state needed to meet a very specific constitutional standard, and that is reasonable, articulable suspicion of drug-related criminal activity. Yet when Trooper Fay called another officer to call in the dog sniff, he didn't mention any facts that might support the sniff. He didn't mention any drugs at all. All he could articulate was that Mr. Boyd was just being shady and fishy. He even asked the other officer what he would need in order to justify the sniff. And the officer responded, "Just trust your gut." And when Trooper Fay testified under oath at the omnibus hearing several months later, he still had difficulty articulating why it was that the dog sniff was called, and even admitted that he just had a hunch, but couldn't put a figure on what he found suspicious about Mr. Boyd. That's simply not good enough under the Constitution. Now, even considering this, the state pointed to four factors challenging Mr. Boyd's motion to suppress. And those were the time of day, or time of night rather, that Mr. Boyd was driving on a public highway, Mr. Boyd's explanation of his whereabouts earlier that day, a butane torch that was found in the truck, and Mr. Boyd's movements when searching his backpack when asked to search for his license. But these are also insufficient to justify a dog sniff, both individually and in their totality. That means the evidence collected after the dog sniff was unconstitutional and must be suppressed, and the district court's failure to do so is reversible error.
Mr. Cron, we got the matrix, and the parties, I think, ultimately got there together, meaning that you, a reviewing court and the district court first, but a reviewing court looks at the facts independently, and then we put them together. And arguably, for the Martinson case, the answers may not be the same. But what's not easy to discern is what's in between there. What makes it not the same? And I wanted to know what your theory or answer to that in looking at all this case law, because is it the number of facts? We know Martinson, I think you identified 16 of them. So it's just a lot of innocent facts. You put a lot of innocent facts together, it becomes more than innocent. Here we only have the four, and we have some good arguments you made about cross-examination that might even neutralize some of those. But so what's the magical answer to when we have a bunch of innocent facts that now we put them together, bam, it's enough reasonable suspicion?
Yes, and thank you for that question, Your Honor. I'll start with the Martinson case. As you pointed out, there were 16 factors that were relied on by the court in that case. That was a drug courier profile case. So different than the situation we have here with the dog sniff of a vehicle. But that case also does not stand for the proposition that a court cannot consider each factor individually. It does not elaborate on that whatsoever. There are cases, however, including the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State v. Lugo, State v. Burback, and this court's decision recently in State v. Guardian, that say that a court, when just as a matter of common sense, has to look at the totality of circumstances, but also may look individually at each factor and assess the strength of each. And I'll quote from the State v. Guardian decision from last year, quote, "We may consider the strength of the suspicion based on the facts independently before considering them in their totality." So Mr. Boyd's position is not that the factors should not be considered also in their totality, but this court may also consider them individually.
So where does the butane torch, everyone likes to talk about that, fit in that analysis?
Sure, and I'll start with the butane torch. And the butane torch, really, this is the factor that the state hangs its hat on, as it's the only factor that even arguably has any association with drug use. Trooper Fay testified that he noticed a butane torch in the driver's side door of Mr. Boyd's truck. He also testified that butane torches are commonly associated with drug use, but Trooper Fay did not testify that butane torches were exclusively used for drugs, and there's nothing in the record that suggests the only use for a butane torch is for drugs. In fact, this court and courts around the country have previously acknowledged that a butane torch is legal to possess. It is a common item that can be used for innocent purposes. I'd point to this court's case in State v. West from 2015. I'd also point to the Oregon Court of Appeals decision in State v. Sherman. Those are both cited in Mr. Boyd's brief. And given the innocent uses of a butane torch, it's perhaps no surprise that Minnesota appellate courts have never found that a butane torch on its own is sufficient to support a dog sniff of a vehicle without other physical indicators of drug use or other objects that are associated with the drug use. This is not a case such as the ones we've cited where, in addition to a butane torch, there were sunken cheeks or dilated pupils, bloodshot eyes, agitations, physical signs of current drug use. This is not a case that also included mechanics gloves or a hypodermic needle that was found also observed in the car. And those are other indicators or physical indicators or other objects that are associated that kind of go to the totality of circumstances. Those are absent here. The only factor that is arguably associated with drug use is the butane torch, but that's it.
Was there any record made at the district court of illegal use of a butane torch, non-drug use? I mean, we have the officer's testimony that says this, there's a butane torch and that is indicative of drug use. Was there any sort of record saying, like, no, there's all these other things that it can be used for?
Not specifically, Your Honor, but I think that can be implied from Trooper Fay's testimony himself. He testified, I think it was, quote, that it is common to use, that butane torches are found associated with drug use. I think the implication there is that is not the exclusive use. This court's decision in State v. West, as we've cited, also acknowledges its common uses. I also think that the district court and this court does not need to dispel common sense that a butane torch is used to heat things. It can be used for other innocent purposes as well.
What do we do with the case law that says we have to defer to the officer when it comes to the training experience that the butane torch is indicative of drug use?
I think in this case, Your Honor, 2 points on that. The first is, as far as this court defers to Trooper Fay's testimony, I think it's important to note that the record shows that the Trooper Fay had been a state trooper for 2 years at that point. His main role was focused on traffic control. There's no evidence about Trooper Fay's relevant training specific to drug detection, anything of that nature. So any deference given to his testimony in this case should keep that in mind. A second point is that the relevant testimony that the state latches onto here, again, is that it is common for butane torches to be associated with drug use, but not exclusively. So I think to the extent the court defers to anything, it could defer to the butane torches being commonly associated. But I don't think this court needs to accept the ultimate determinative issue, as was stated in State v. Garding, which is whether reasonable suspicion exists. That is, that this court can independently review the facts in the record and determine as a matter of law whether reasonable suspicion exists.
I mean, that sort of gets, if we independently are reviewing the facts and not deferring to the police officer, aren't we then trying to write around the idea of what the Supreme Court and our precedential cases have said, that we do have to defer to an officer on this sort of testimony and the fact findings that the district court then makes, which we review for clear error?
And perhaps I didn't state this as clearly before either. I think to the extent this court gives deference to Trooper Fay, it should be in the context of his background, but also for the limited purpose of deferring to his testimony that it is commonly associated with drug use.
Thank you.
Now, I would like to touch on the remaining factors as well, even though they are unrelated to drugs. Should be given little weight, if any, by the court, but I'd like to go through them nonetheless to illustrate that point. Now, as far as the time of day, Mr. Boyd was pulled over on Highway 60, a public highway, just before 1 a.m. He was one of many cars observed by Trooper Fay at that time. Now, the state doesn't dispute the driving on a highway at night or any time of day, for that matter, is indicative of drug-related activity, or even suspicious, for that matter, of any criminal activity. So this isn't a situation where Mr. Boyd's location at a certain time in a certain place suggests something nefarious going on or raises suspicions at all, never mind drug activity.
Counsel, getting to that, maybe again to the overall, I think the quote we heard from the trooper, maybe when he was talking to the canine deputy over the phone, is something's fishy. I think it was fishy or shady. Shady, that's what it
right.
Shady. What is your interpretation of what he was referring to, or which of the facts, or is it just all the same facts we're talking about? What's the shady part that you saw?
Well, I think that's best answered by the state in this case, but I think it shows that Trooper Fay had a hunch. He did not know exactly why he was calling for a dog sniff at that point, and he couldn't articulate it. He admitted later on cross that it was a hunch. So I really do think that just shows the absence of a reasonable suspicion in this case.
Could it be in part the Boyd's answer to it, since it was nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, to working? Could that be part of it? There wasn't a good detailed explanation.
That's what the state argues. That's certainly not what Trooper Fay articulated at that time when calling for the dog sniff. As far as Mr. Boyd's explanation of his whereabouts that day, I think if the court looks at the body cam footage in this case, the conversation lasted well over 10 minutes. I think over the course of 13 minutes or so, Trooper Fay asked Mr. Boyd different questions, including about his whereabouts that day on three different occasions. And while Mr. Boyd's answers weren't always a model of clarity, I don't think Trooper Fay's questions were either. And I think the body cam footage establishes that Mr. Boyd's explanations was more evolved. He added details in response to Trooper Fay's increasingly specific questions. So I don't think the record supports that his explanation was inconsistent. And Trooper Fay at the omnibus hearing, in fact, admitted that his explanation, although he may have found it odd, was consistent. I'd also point to this court's decisions in State v. Guardian and State v. Christensen, saying that even inconsistencies in explanation about whereabouts or marks on skin, to the extent they're indicative of anything, it may be suspicious activity. They are not related to drug-related activity, which is the constitutional standard here. Finally, I'd like to touch on briefly on Mr. Boyd's behavior with his backpack, which the state relies on as one of the factors. I think it's important to note that Trooper Fay, he was on the driver's side door. He asked Mr. Boyd to retrieve his license, as most traffic stops do. Mr. Boyd thought his driver's license was in his backpack, which was placed on the passenger seat opposite side of Trooper Fay. Mr. Boyd turned to try to find his driver's license in his backpack. And this is all established in the body cam footage as well, which this court can review. When he had difficulty finding it, he put it on the center console and eventually actually put it on his lap within inches of where Trooper Fay was standing. This is not deceptive behavior. This is not indicative of, this is not suspicious activity. This is certainly not indicative of drug-related activity. So that too, I think the court should not give any weight at all in considering the totality of circumstances. Now I see I'm out of time here. I'd like to reserve rebuttal as well, and ask that this court reverse the district court's decision and vacate Mr. Boyd's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready.
May it please, excuse me. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. I want to start with the motive analysis here, because the state disagrees with the motive analysis employed by the respondent and with the motive analysis this court used in its unpublished decision in Guarding. That motive analysis is an improper motive analysis. The reasonable articulable suspicion analysis requires courts to look at the facts in their totality, and any one fact, though innocent by itself, can contribute to the totality of the circumstances. In particular, I would note that respondent points to State v. Lugo, claiming it supports this mode of analysis. It does not. If you look at the relevant pages in the Lugo discussion, what the Supreme Court in Lugo did is identify the facts. This isn't a multi-factor test. We're looking at facts. It identified the facts. It said those are relevant to the analysis. It then weighed all of them together to reach a conclusion about reasonable articulable suspicion. The Supreme Court in Lugo did not weigh each individual fact and say it provides weak evidence or strong evidence. Instead, it took them all together to determine whether reasonable articulable suspicion exists.
And Mr. Smith, I'm not sure I can discern a distinction when I look at the case law. Certainly the ultimate decision is the totality of the circumstances, but how is it different to say, okay, what are our circumstances? Okay, time of day, look for a license, explanation of where he was, and a butane torch. And now we put them all together, but you still, isn't it just necessarily an academic requirement to what are these circumstances? And so you do look at them, and then when you look at a transcript, each one is addressed, and there's an explanation on direct, and then there's a cross-examination. And so what really is the difference between mode?
I think the key difference here is highlighted by the frequent refrain in appellant's argument that these individual facts don't relate to drug-related criminal activity. That's not the question. The question isn't whether each individual fact by itself has some connection to drug-related activity. The question is whether all of the facts taken together provide a reasonable suspicion, that is more than a mere hunch, whim, or idle curiosity, that drugs will be found. And that's the significant difference in the mode of analysis I see here, because these
Let's assume, and I understand you got a differing argument about the butane torch, but if none of them individually suggest drug activity, how can you magically put them together and now we have drug activity?
Well, I think the Martinson case probably provides the kind of analysis there where you have a whole bunch of innocent factors by themselves where none of them by themselves might be definitive or particularly indicative of drug-related criminal activity. But when the whole picture is taken together, it all comes into focus, and maybe you fit, and you have to filter that through the officer's training and experience too, and the inferences.
And there you had it was a drug courier. I think that's the case. So, in other words, you kind of have a bit of a background already going into it, and here we have a vehicle driving 45 miles per hour as it's traveling a semi during the construction zone at 1 a.m.
Well, you have that, and then you have more. You also have the vehicle weaving within its lane, which certainly is a fact that courts have long recognized can be indicative of somebody being impaired. They can be impaired by drugs or impaired by alcohol. So it doesn't have no connection to drugs. I think that's the important.
Maybe that gets to our mode, though. Mm-hmm. So each one of these kind of that gets ruled out, right? The trooper didn't. There was no signs of impairment, so that quickly gets kind of becomes a neutral. And then, getting back to the mode, right, how do you not look at these individually and then put them all together? You kind of do it all as part of your analysis.
I think that's the problem, though, I don't think we get to rule out a fact just because it might have some innocent explanation. That's the important thing to note here.
Well, just to get though on using that, it's not a might have an explanation. There was one. In other words, the trooper said there was no sign of impairment. That would be the logical first presumption of why you're weaving. And so when we're looking at the record, we do look at it in totality, but those are all important, aren't they? And what the transcript says in terms of explanations and cross-examination and to get an understanding of what the trooper's articulating as the suspicion of drug activity.
Well, that leads to a second point in appellant's approach to the analysis that I disagree with, which is the heavy reliance on the subjective beliefs of the trooper. Those are irrelevant to the analysis. The subjective beliefs of the trooper are set aside. I mean, the flip side certainly wouldn't be true if the trooper, just testified, I had reasonable articulable suspicion. We wouldn't care about that. So I thought I had it. We wouldn't care about that. What we care about are the objective facts that the trooper testifies to, and then the question becomes whether on those facts it's reasonable to suspect a drug-related activity. That's the standard Fourth Amendment mode of analysis, and I think that's important to bear in mind here. It doesn't matter if the trooper didn't consider a particular fact, as long as he testified to the existence of the fact. That goes in the pot.
Well, but here's the issue that I'm having with this case. So we have what the officer testified to months later after they've done an inventory of the car and the whole bit. But in this situation, we have a real-time phone call that he's making to his supervisor where he is articulating what his suspicion is and why he wants a dog sniff. Within that phone call, he never says anything about a butane torch. And he's primarily relying on the idea that his story doesn't line up and there's something fishy here. And then he's told, trust your gut. And he immediately calls in the dogs. So it feels like we have a real time analysis of what his reasonable articular suspicion was when he was talking to his supervisor. So why don't we look at that piece of it and give import to that?
Well, I think there are two reasons. The first reason is, again, those reflect his subjective beliefs about what's going on. Rather than he's not making a list of his the objective observations. The second thing is that the district court here credited the officer's testimony about these observations. And that's critically important because there is evidence in the record, both in the form of the video and in the form of the officer's testimony that supports the district court's findings of fact. This court reviews those findings of fact for clear error, and it does not disturb a district court's credibility determinations. It's clear here that the district court credited the officer's testimony about his observations and about his observation of the butane torch. And therefore, unless that fact has no support whatsoever in the record, this court's stuck with that fact.
Can't we look at both his the phone call, the transcript of the phone call, and his testimony as two facts that we would consider as well about what he saw?
You can certainly. Well, the district court gets to look at the facts and decide what the facts are. And it's this court's job to decide whether the district court's findings of fact and its decision to credit testimony are clearly erroneous. So I don't think, based on the record here, this court can say there are no facts in the record that would support the district court's finding of fact. And the district court credited the testimony about the butane torch, and it relied upon it in its analysis of the totality of the circumstances. And that's appropriate. And this court should not set aside that crediting of the testimony.
Mr. Smith, can I follow up with my colleague's question? Because one of the findings the judge made is that Boyd concealed his backpack. Now, getting back to the real time, we've got the video, and I looked at it, and frankly, the appellant's point on this is pretty good, is that he had to turn his back. The concealing seemed to be explained by he turned his back and was hiding it from me. So the only evidence, of course, of concealing would be his statement. It was concealing, but the judge and we look at this, and he is digging through it, and then he puts it on his lap, right, with the trooper shining a flashlight right over it. So isn't that an example where we might find the record doesn't support a finding that he was concealing a backpack?
I don't think it is, because I think that reasonable jurists looking at the same fact, same video, can reach different conclusions. And the clearly erroneous standard of review doesn't allow the reviewing court to look at the facts and say, well, I would have decided this different in the first instance.
You have to decide if the record supports that.
That's correct. So the officer testified that this behavior was deceptive. The district court heard that testimony. It's also abundantly clear from the district court's order that it watched the video and considered the video. Taking all of the evidence together, it determined as a matter of fact that the appellant concealed the bag. And I mean, I've watched the video too, and I quite frankly think that the way the appellant is dealing with the bag is deceptive. And the other thing is that the officer is entitled to some deference in the inference he draws about the behavior based on his training and experience. He's the one who's out there dealing with traffic stops on an everyday basis, has the experience of how people normally behave. That's why we defer to officer inferences based on their training and experience, is because they're the one with the practical boots on the ground experience dealing with this. They're the ones who know what's normal and what's not during the course of these traffic stops. And I think when you look at the video, the behavior is odd. And it certainly, the video supports the district court's finding, and it doesn't directly conflict with the district court's finding. And there's the officer testimony. So again, the standard is clearly erroneous. And that means that this court only reverses if there's no record support for the finding. And at the very least, the officer's testimony, which was credited by the district court, provides some record support. And I would submit it's not inconsistent with the video. Just because there might be different conclusions reached by different viewers ultimately doesn't mean that a particular piece of evidence renders the finding clearly erroneous.
What if this was the officer's second week on the job?
You know, perhaps that would, you know, factor in more strongly. But again, I think those factors, how long the officer's been on the job and their relative experience, all of those things, those are things for the district court to consider in determining whether to credit testimony and how much weight, if any, to give testimony. Again, deciding whether to credit testimony and weighing testimony is the job of district courts. That's what they do when they make findings of fact. This court's task on review is not to weigh the strengths of the evidence. That's the district court's job to weigh the strengths of the evidence in making findings of fact. The district court did that. It heard the testimony about how long the trooper had been working. It credited his testimony about, for example, the fact that in his training experience, which he testified to, the butane torches are commonly associated with drug activity. That's in the record. The district court credited that fact. There is nothing in the record to the earlier question about what other legal uses of the torch.
Wasn't it true, though, when the trooper stopped him, he was smoking a cigarette? Well, wouldn't that right there be a common sense possibility and use of the butane torch?
It may well be, but what there isn't anything about anything here is record evidence of the fact that that's a common
would
use of these
it?
Kind
would,
of torches.
Why would we need it if it's everybody agrees it's a legal item? In fact, I smoke cigars and pipes once in a while, and I've got butane lighter. I suspect that we don't need a record to say a butane lighter has legal uses. The whole point here is he wanted to explain also it has commonly known to be used for drug use.
Well, I think we got to be careful because one, this court's precedent is clear. And the Supreme Court's precedent is clear too, that when reviewing the district court's suppression motion decisions on suppression motions, the review was limited to the facts and the record at the time the decision was made. Second, if the common sense that this is either innocent or odd applies, then I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And the common sense that when you claim to be, for example, working as a scrapper and coming back from work, working late at 1 a.m, that something's amiss in that explanation just because the officer doesn't explicitly testify to it, then I think it's fair for the state to argue that. So if common sense can be argued on one side, then it gets to be argued on the other.
But Mr. Smith, you would also agree that commonly doesn't mean only. So the testimony doesn't foreclose the possibility of lawful uses of the butane torch.
Certainly, but the reasonable articulable suspicion and even the probable cause standard don't require the evidence to foreclose innocent explanations. In fact, reasonable articulable suspicion and probable cause can exist in the face of actual innocent explanations for the conduct.
But the key here is also sort of to bring things back to the center of the issue. We're looking at whether or not there was reasonable articulable suspicion for a dog sniff, and therefore it has to also be suspicion of drug-related activity. And so you're out of time, but I assume your position is that, in fact, all four of these factors in their totality are sufficient to find that there was reasonable articulable suspicion for drug-related activity.
Judge Schmidt, may I answer?
Please.
That's precisely the state's position, is that when they're taken in their totality, I think there are more than four factors. We didn't get to running through the list necessarily, but I think when you look at all of the factors identified by the district court and supported by the record, that in their totality, they do provide the suspicion of drug-related criminal activity. And certainly the butane torch provides the strongest link specifically to drug-related activity. And that's why appellant tries so hard to throw it out of the circumstances. But this court's not free to do that. Thank you. I would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you. And just a few points to respond to. I'll start with the motive analysis argument that the state has put forward and disagrees that Guardian was correctly decided. I would posit that Guardian was correctly decided in finding that the evidence in that case needed to be suppressed because the dog sniff was unconstitutional. As counsel pointed out, Guardian cited not only State v. Lugo, a Supreme Court decision, also State v. Burback. In both cases, the Supreme Court did not give any weight to factors that were not related to drugs. It did not consider them as part of the totality of circumstances. And I think it's difficult to imagine how a court goes about viewing the totality of circumstances without also considering each factor. They go hand in hand. And here, I think as the Supreme Court said in State v. Askaruth, the factors, when considered in their totality, fail to sufficiently supplement one another to make the sum any greater than their parts. And I think that's really what we're getting at here. A second point, counsel mentioned that the subjective beliefs are irrelevant in this case, the subjective beliefs of Trooper Fay. I would say that the Trooper Fay's, as your honors have mentioned, Trooper Fay in the moment could not articulate why he was calling in a dog sniff, other than finding Mr. Boyd shady and that something was fishy. That is certainly relevant to the analysis, and I don't think this court needs to ignore that body cam footage and ignore reality. When a trooper testifies that he had a hunch about something, I think this court should take that as part of the circumstances being considered.
How do we get around that, though, with as appellant counsel notes, that the district court made the findings and credited the trooper?
I think the findings that the state is latching onto here, for example, the behavior being deceptive with the backpack, I think that is the court's characterization of what Trooper Fay testified to. I don't think that's the relevant facts at issue here. I don't think that's a finding of fact. I think the relevant fact here that the court could consider is the body cam footage. That's in the record. And to the extent the court was saying anything about what that body cam footage showed, that's simply a characterization of the facts in the record. And I think that brings me to my third point.
I don't disagree with you with the idea that when we have body cam, especially like this, where we have a body cam where he's calling his superior officer and saying, this is fishy, that maybe we should look at it differently. But that's not what the precedent says. And we're an error correcting court, and we can't make that to be the law. So how do we deal with that in the context of what the Supreme Court has told us?
Here, I don't think the statements that the state is relying on in the court's order are findings of fact. If this court views them as findings of fact, I do still think that there is clear error there. And I don't think that the body cam footage or any of the other evidence in the record that we've discussed supports such a finding in this case. I would also point to the Supreme Court's decision in State v. Harris and State v. Gouster. And in those cases, the Supreme Court stated that when reviewing a motion to suppress, the court can independently review the facts in the record and as a matter of law determine the ultimate issue of whether reasonable suspicion exists. Counsel danced around this a little bit in acknowledging it, but I think, just driving it home, I think this court does not need to ignore the best evidence we have here, which is the body cam footage, which does not show that Mr. Boyd was being deceptive. And I think goes contrary to what the state is arguing here. If there are no further questions, I would wrap up by just asking this court to reverse the district court's motion to suppress and vacate Mr. Boyd's conviction and sentence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today, for your arguments in your briefs as well. It's very well argued and briefed. We will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. Case is submitted.